The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am but one of your entomological hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
And I'm another one of your hosts. I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm the last host today, Michael Scavarla of Penn State University.
You centered it a little bit. You didn't go quite as big as I was anticipating.
Oh, I can. I'm Michael Scavarla.
Sorry to those of you who are wearing earbuds.
That was a little angry too. I don't know what
it happened. Was a little angry. I think there was maybe something hidden behind that. Maybe some unexplored feelings. Welcome to Arthropod. We're very excited to be rejoining you today. We are doing our first recording for the month of May. We're very excited to be getting together to talk about mantids and mantises. We'll probably talk about some of that nomenclature here today. But how are you guys doing? Like, what's up? What's the scoop? It's bug time in all of our respective states. Is everything starting to ramp up?
Oh, yeah. What are your top five?
Right now, it's all European hornets, baby. Did I get a murder hornet, Jonathan?
Same. I've gotten multiple European hornets. Last week, maybe 10 days ago, I got 8 hammerhead worm requests in a week.
Yeah.
Which prompted me to write a fact sheet on terrestrial flatworms.
Tell people a little more about hammerhead worms, Mike. Why are people contacting you about them? They don't even have legs. I mean, they really shouldn't be under your purview.
Yeah, they're not really under entomology purview, but I get them a lot, and there's literally nobody else to take it. So it's kind of like the invasive jumping worms.
Yeah.
Where there, I mean, maybe the turf grass entomology folks could take those, but there's nobody to take them in an extension. So like, I just do it. Yeah. So terrestrial flatworms are flatworms. So you might be familiar with planaria. They're like these little worms that are flat, platyhelminthes, that typically are aquatic. And you, like, you see them in biology class because they have really neat regenerative properties. You could like cut their head in half and they'll grow two heads, or chop their body in half and like the head part will grow a new tail and the tail part will grow a new head. And so they're used in biology a lot, like high school biology type stuff. And most people, if they're familiar with them at all, know the aquatic ones. There's a bunch in the tropics that are terrestrial. So they crawl around and eat things, soft bodied things, typically
slugs, worms, snails, slugs.
Yeah. There's been a couple species introduced into North America that have these big hammerheads. They're like these crescent shaped heads, and they eat earthworms, and some of them are big. Bipalium cuense can get up to a foot long, so yeah. It's this big foot long thin yellow wormy thing that's crawling out in your garden, and people worry like, what's this doing? And then they learn it eats earthworms and they get scared because it eats earthworms. Turns out, at least here in Pennsylvania, almost all of our earthworms are introduced also, so like, it's an invasive eating invasive, so I don't really care.
We'll be returning to that sentiment.
Yeah,
here,
maybe even episode could be considered biological control of these invasive earthworms.
That's what I was going to ask about.
The fact sheet centered on Pennsylvania, but included all of Eastern North America. So here, most of our native earthworms are forest species that you find typically like under logs and under the bark of fallen trees. And so not really where you find these flatworms. So natives aren't too at risk. People find these things in their gardens and they worry because they eat earthworms. And so I have this whole spiel like I just gave, like, well, they're probably not hurting the earthworms that matter. But it turns out we actually have 15 species of terrestrial flatworms in Eastern North America, which is way more than I thought, including a couple that are native, which blew my mind because I thought all of our terrestrial flatworms were invasive. And so it was a really neat thing for me to dive into and hopefully get this information out to people. Bring them in with the hammerhead worms because that's what they're concerned about. But then I profiled all of the species, including the natives that we have, to try to like, but here's these other cool things.
Are they really prevalent? Like, could we find them anywhere? And are they distributed throughout the US?
So the introduced species typically are found similar places like the invasive jumping worms, like they're in
nursery stock.
And, yeah. So Bipalium cuense, the big species that gets to a foot long, is not known. It's not known where its native range is because it's only known as it is an invasive. Worldwide, we suspect other Bipalium species are native to Southeast Asia. So we're like, yeah, it's probably from there, but it's never been found in its native habitat. It's named cuense after the Kew Gardens in the United Kingdom because that's where it was first discovered as an introduced invasive. Bipalium pennsylvanicum is the same story. We don't know where it's from either, but it was found in Pennsylvania.
Jonathan, have you ever had a hammerhead worm come in?
Oh, yeah. We've had lots of questions on those recently. I did a newsletter about it a little while ago just because, yeah, we were getting tons of agent questions on it. A lot of ours were driven by social media posts. I had this one sent to me multiple times where it was like a wanted poster kind of looking thing. And it was about how these flatworms are out there. They're foot long. They eat all our cool earthworms. And they're also full of tetrodotoxin. So if you touch it, it'll kill you. And there was some fear mongering going on that we had to kind of fight back against.
So those are all lies, right?
It does have tetrodotoxin. One of the species does. I can't remember off the top of my head which it is, but if you like graze a flatworm, it's not
safe. Is it safe for birds and my pets?
I would say no. That was the other thing. People wanted to know if they could feed them to their chickens. That seems to be like a go-to move for a lot of folks. And I was like, no, I wouldn't do that. Because I had a media interview about it and I made some joke like, unless you sat down and ate a plate full of flatworms, you'd probably be fine. And then they were asked about the chicken thing. It's like, no, I wouldn't do that either.
Yeah. They're incredibly distasteful. So even if you did feed it to the chickens, I can't imagine they would actually eat more than one.
Yeah. It just doesn't seem like it. Yeah. There's a reason that they're probably able to move in is because, nothing wants to gobble them up. So there's been a lot of questions on that. I think it's an interesting little phenomenon, just like Mike was talking about, to all of a sudden have people. They also want to go out and like dump salt all over everything to try and kill them. We've tried to convince them that they should put like scoop it into a bag and then put the salt in there. Like if you really want to destroy it, don't just salt your landscape.
Right. Because if they're indestructible and if you cut them in half and they regenerate, like how do you get rid of them?
If you have to get rid of them, they melt under salt and vinegar, I guess, is what I've read from some sources. So you really feel compelled.
They're really well established. Listen to what we're going to say about mantises coming up, and basically the same thing applies to hammerhead flatworms.
And being in Nebraska, I have to say, I get a lot of invasive jumping worms, and I've received one hammerhead worm once, and I kept them alive for a while, watched them, cut them in half. They were incredibly interesting to me because, I'm so curious. But then I was like, okay, I've distracted myself with this enough. But I haven't received another inquiry, but I will definitely take a look at your publication.
Or Jody Green describing her serial killer-like behavior here on the show.
Just watching to see what happens.
I just observe the human condition.
I don't interfere. I just watch. I'm a voyeur.
So it sounds like we're all kind of ramping up. We all have similar problems maybe kind of coming in. It sounds like maybe Jody doesn't quite have the flatworm pressure that Mike and I are under, but maybe in the future we can mail you some.
Nothing. I get really scared when I get like real mail samples.
Oh,
like snail mail samples. Right now I've got a lot of clover mites. We're just warming up like to 90 degrees today. Last week I was like wrapped in a blanket and had a winter hat on. And this week it's like 90 something, but we've had swarming termites, swarming carpenter ants, all the fun stuff that I like. I'm too busy.
We're getting active. There's not enough of us and too many bugs. It sounds like.
Yes.
The other thing that it sounds like we've all gotten questions on recently that has prompted some texting and some conversations between the arthropod crew has been this weird increase over the last couple of years on questions regarding Chinese mantises and if we should try to destroy all of them as often as possible. Jody, do you kind of want to set the stage here? Like, what kind of questions have you been getting about this? And then why are we talking about this today?
So I've been getting a lot of pictures of what is this? Is it dangerous? And then if it's just an ID, I'll say this is a Utheca or egg case of a Chinese mantid. And then I'll get the, so should I kill it? I was told these are very dangerous and, you know, they're harming the ecosystem. Should I kill it? What would you do? Most of the time, if people know me, they know I actually don't, like, I specialize in IPM and I'm a nature lover and I kind of let things live. Like, I let a lot of things go outside. I think they're worried that they are, that we have native mantids and that it's ruining their lives. And also the fact that these are very huge mantids that are not from here. There have been a lot of questions on social media, on Facebook. There's groups that are out to send information that's to kill them. So have you guys had those kind of questions as well?
Yeah. I think it's an interesting switch that I've seen in the last couple of years, because especially growing up and even the first year or two that I was at Penn State in like 2017 and 18, people had the misconception like mantises are protected by law. You can't kill any of them because like it's illegal. I heard that so much growing up, and even into the late 20 teens was getting questions like, is this real? Like, can you kill these things? It's like, what's going on? And then, yeah, in the last probably 2 to 3 years, there's just been a 180 degree shift of people recognizing that Chinese mantises are not native, but then going the step further and saying, well, I should kill all of them. And I think some of it is driven by the fear of them eating monarchs, because they will eat monarchs. They're big generalist predators that will eat anything that you put in front of them. They'll eat brown marmorated stink bugs and spotted lanternflies and other invasives, but they'll also eat lots of natives because they need to eat and they eat everything. They also eat hummingbirds on occasion, and people don't like that. And so there's been this, yeah, this big jump of they're not native, so I will kill all of them. Or should I kill all of them? Or how do I kill all of them? So I've definitely seen a big shift in questions about them.
Similar to Mike. Yeah. I grew up, everybody really liked mantids. Everybody wanted them in their garden. Like, I remember specifically my grandpa wanting me to like give him the Uthecas that I would find, and he would like set them up near his garden so they could hatch. It just seemed like they were really well regarded. And even then, like, it was known that most of the time it was Chinese mantids. Like, nobody seemed to have any compunctions about this, that the Chinese and European mantids were just sort of part of the ecosystem at this point. But then I guess I didn't start getting it until the last year or so, maybe. A lot of these questions that are very pointed, like Mike said, about, you know, how do I get rid of these, rather than questions about like what a mantis is and what it does. The Uthecas are brought up as like, should I be crushing this? Like, how do I pulverize this? How do I get rid of these? It was quite shocking to me, I guess. I wasn't prepared for this attitudinal shift in regards to things that are often, you know, like if we made an all-star list of bugs, I think mantises would be on that team. They're usually very popular. Like, they're a charismatic looking insect, weird triangular heads, historically thought of as like wise and prophetic bugs. But now it seems like, yeah, everybody wants to get rid of this specific species, the Chinese mantis. And I wasn't quite prepared for that.
Actually, looking at the picture poster thing that you gave me, it was all mantids. Because I love mantids. And I still do. I've had to educate some master gardeners about it too, because we know that people call them, and we have over, you know, 200. So just the type of messaging that's out there. And as we've talked about in the past, it's always hard to compete with, I guess, negative messaging. And I don't really tell people what to do, but I'm trying to educate them about what mantids are. And I think when it comes to humans, there's a good, something is good or something is bad, but that's relative to how humans think, right? So for a while, all mantids were good. And now it's like, there is good mantids, and then there is the Chinese mantid, and they're bad. And this is the reason why they're bad. Can we talk about like what a praying mantis is? Like, let's just talk about that, because sometimes they do get misidentified as other things. Stick insects, I guess, especially, or the
bugs, Katie.
Yeah,
bugs.
Or the mantid fly, which I have not seen.
Yeah, mantises are big generalist predators. They're usually an inch or more in length, it seems like, and some species get up to 4 or 5 inches long. When we're talking about the Chinese mantis, many of them are green, some of them are brown. Some of them, when they sit on orchids or other fancy flowers, they can be pink and have like elongations on their body. Mantids are very spectacular looking organisms, and they're very famous for their triangular shaped heads. Generally, they have these big eyes that kind of take over the two sort of opposing orbs of their triangular heads. We often see these like pseudo pupils in their eyes where we're staring down into the eye. And so we see this black dot, which gives them, I think, more of a living expression that people seem to be captivated by. And then they have those raptorial legs in the front. Their first legs are raptorial that they use to capture their prey. Very spectacular looking thing to most people. They have these bear trap arms, basically, that they use to grab onto stuff and then move it towards their mouth. Mantids are also very famous for the females eating males. I don't know about you guys, but I get a lot of comic strips forwarded to me from people that have laughed at bug jokes and stuff. And I would say maybe like 70% of them are based around that joke about a male mantis being eaten by a female. So they're extremely famous critters. Like, people generally really love them.
Yeah, they're fun to have as pets because and I usually keep one at the end of the season when it's too cold and keep it inside to the end of her life. But they turn their heads and look at you, and it's freaky. Like, they're very, very interesting.
They almost seem like they have expressions. Like, they seem more alive than other insects to people, I feel like.
I mean, it's like jumping spiders, the big eyes that look at you. And then they do, like you said, they look at you. So people, like, there's a connection there that... Yeah, but it's easy to miss with other insects.
I think it would be important to also point out that they're closely related to termites. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. Termites and, well, you know, termites are cockroaches. So right. They're closely related to cockroaches.
Yeah. They're all orthopteroids. So they're in the larger group with cockroaches and katydids and grasshoppers. The raptorial forelegs will help you distinguish mantises from all of the other things, though. Walking sticks.
And then the mantis flies, or is it mantid flies? I've never seen one. They have raptorial legs too, right?
Yeah, so there's other insects that have raptorial forelegs. Mantispids or mantid flies are perhaps the most similar to mantises proper. They're actually neuropterans, so they're related to green lacewings and antlions and things, but they've got similarly convergent evolution of the forelegs and the raptorial forearms. Some flies do that too, like ephedrids and some things. There's actually a number of groups that have developed these kind of raptorial grasping forelegs for eating. But mantises are the most famous because they're the biggest and the most widespread and easiest to find.
It's really cool. Have you ever had your finger caught in the raptorial leg of praying mantis?
I have. I've been nibbled on by a praying mantis before. My daughter still brings it up from time to time. She's like, remember that time that the praying mantis tried to eat you? It had my forefinger, I think, and it was trying to take a nibble out of me.
Did it hurt?
It pinched, but it wasn't as bad as the earwig that got me the one time.
To go back to the femme fatale, whatever, aura of that, like sexual cannibalism, I have seen it once.
You've seen it in person once?
Yeah, well, I didn't see it happen, but I was watching, and it was Carolina mantids. They were mating and he had no head on my sedum. It's like my most famous Twitter picture, probably.
Oh, wow.
And actually, Dr. Judy Wu Smart did a sculpture for me. It's a 3D sculpture of that picture. I'm going to grab it off my wall.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So we've got
we'll have to take a picture so we can put that on the show notes.
And it was like the day before someone had said, hey, is it true that the female mantid eats the male? And I was like, I don't know. I have not seen that happen. I don't think it happens in all cases. You know, there's probably some percent and it probably depends on the environment, blah, blah, because it does, like, you know, what she needs, her health, all those things,
right.
You know, for eggs. But then I walked out my front door and that was actually, there was a male and female and I went to the garden, came back, and she was mating, but not with the male that was there. Yeah, I was like, wow, this is actually happening. So I took a bunch of pictures, and then I got bored because it was, they kept mating without a head. And then I was like, I wonder what happens. Like, does she end up eating the rest of his body? And no, she doesn't.
Really?
The next day I found his body in a plant. She was off doing her own thing. Huh. And I did see her like eating like honeybee, you know, so our native mantids also are generals, predators, and eat whatever they feel like eating, whatever they can catch. So pollinators and whatever, but she was eating while she was mating. She, it was like, she didn't know and didn't care, but she was mating with a headless male.
I use that when I teach master gardeners about insect anatomy a lot. We talk about how insects have multiple brains or ganglia technically. And I talk about and show video of that happening and say like, this is an action that they are able to complete. This mating shows that they have these multiple ganglia that can help with different parts of their body. So even though he's missing the first half of his whole self, he's still able to complete this process, perhaps even better, after losing his main brain.
Probably. And she gets benefit, right? From.
Right. Yeah. She's getting food and everything. So there's reasons for it happening.
He gets a benefit.
Yeah. He's passing his genes on. The other thing I think that would be helpful for us to set the stage with here is we're talking about these mantises. We're talking about these questions that we get in regards to Chinese mantises specifically. So let's break down these three sort of competing species in people's eyes and talk about like what is driving some of this sort of antagonism towards Chinese mantises specifically. So with the Chinese mantis, Mike, can you describe its size and maybe help people understand how they would identify it in the field?
Before we get into that, or as a lead up to that, I want to do what mantises we just have in the Eastern US period, or I guess in the United States, because it's going to answer some questions some people might have, and it's more than you'd think. So there's actually six families of Mantoidae, the order Mantoidae, all of the mantises. There are six families in North America, of which Mantidae is just one of them. It has the most species, and the species you're probably most familiar with. So with insects and other animals, when we shorten a family name down, like Mantidae just turns into Mantids. You drop the AE off the end, so Mantidae to Mantids. So all mantids are mantises because they're in the same superfamily, but not all mantises are mantids because not all of them are in that family. Now in all three states where we're at, in Northern and Eastern North America, everything we have here are in the family Mantidae. So if you say mantis or mantid, you're technically correct with all of it because all of our mantises are in the family Mantidae. However, if you get into the Southeast, say Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Texas, even up into Arkansas, you start getting all of these other families. So not all of your mantises down there are mantids. You've got things like Copteropterygidae, Lutergustidae, Mantidae, Mantoididae, Pterychoididae, and Thespidae.
Ooh, actors.
Yeah. And some of these are native, but some of them, the entire family is only represented by other introduced species. So for example, Mantoididae, that family is only represented in the United States by I've forgotten the name. It's the Yucatan little mantis, which is native to the Yucatan in Mexico. But it's introduced and widely established in Florida because it's a tropical thing and Florida gets all the tropical invasives. So we've got that family in Florida, the only representative, but the whole family in North America, north of Mexico, is invasive. In the Northeast here, we only have mantids, so you can use the names interchangeably. But when you go into the Southeast, you've got a whole smattering of species and families, and all of them are mantises, but not all of them are mantids. Because you've got more family diversity, you've got more ecological diversity. So some of the mantises down there are bark specialists. They are really flat and they live on trees and on bark and they scuttle around on the bark. They don't look like you would expect of, say, a Chinese mantis. They also have really small ones. So the Yucatan little mantis only gets up to about a centimeter long. They're very small. Some of them are grass mimics. So they live in grassy fields and in plains areas. And so they're long and thin and look like walking sticks with small raptorial legs because they're mimicking grass. But up here in northern North America, in Pennsylvania and Kentucky and Nebraska and in these areas, we've primarily got four species. Three of them are introduced. So we've got Carolina mantises, which are the native species. They're also the smallest. They're about 2 inches long, I'd say. The females and the males are different colors. The females can be bright green. The males are kind of a duller olive green, I guess, and a brown.
I think that's a good description, that olive. Yeah. Yeah.
A khaki green, if you can
make it. Like an army kind of uniform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not brown. It's not green, like bright green. The European mantises, which are primarily in the eastern parts of the Northeast, we have them in Pennsylvania. They're not super common and abundant. I've never seen one, but they are here. They are bright green and they're bigger. They're like 3 to 3.5 inches, 4 inches maybe. And then two species of Tenedera, Chinese mantises and narrowing mantises. And the two species can be told apart by a spot on their thorax. So if you flip the mantis over between its two raptorial forelegs, there is either an orange or a yellow spot. And narrowing mantises have an orange spot, and Chinese mantises have a yellow spot. Both species are bigger. They're up to 4 inches long, and they can be green to a similar kind of olive drab brown and a tan brown. But they're the biggest species. So if you've seen big mantises around, probably a Chinese mantis. Narrowing mantises are not widespread. They're in Pennsylvania and surrounding states in the east. They're not nearly as common either. I've never, again, seen one. So those are the four main players we've got here. One native species, three introduced. And then in addition to just adults and the juveniles, you can easily distinguish their egg cases, the uotheca. Every species has a uniquely shaped uotheca. So often, probably half of the ID requests I get are for uotheca because somebody found it and they don't know how to tell the Chinese mantises from, say, Carolina mantises.
One of my favorite things with uothecas and ID requests regarding them is when they come from Christmas trees. People find them like deep down in the live tree that they've bought and brought in, or they have, you know, a few hundred baby mantises coming out right around Christmas Eve. So that's a good overview of kind of the central players to this. It does seem like it boils down in most people's heads to Carolina, Chinese, and European mantises. I'm trying to not say mantis.
They're all mantids up here.
So I know, but you are right. Like, we have to be very careful when we use that nomenclature. And Master Gardeners ask that kind of question frequently. Like, oh, you said mantid. Why aren't you using S's? Why are you using D's? Like, you know.
It's... So this is one of the places I, in my own speech, try to be correct every time. So I'll typically default to mantises, but I don't begrudge people for being sloppy with it. It's like when you call insects bugs, but they're not true bugs. It's like, I don't do it myself because I want to be correct. But if somebody says it, I'm also not going to correct them because, like, fine, whatever. It's a common name or we're just speaking here. If that makes sense.
It does.
But you make a note of it. Like,
no, I don't even do that. Like, okay. I just make sure that I am always correct.
Right. But is it ever, it's never manti.
No. Have you seen that?
I've heard people say, like, yeah, instead of praying mantises, because I'll say praying mantises and people are like manti. I'm like,
No.
But I'm not.
They're trying to make it like octopus, but octopus and octopi is not correct either because, let's dive into language for a minute.
Oh, no.
So the I ending for plural and singular, turning something from an US to an I ending for this plural is Latin. It's like Latin in the first declension, but octopus is Greek. So it's not from Latin. So technically, plural for octopus, if you want to be pedantic, is octopodes, because pus to podes in Greek is more correct, because it's not Latin. So it sounds like people are trying to make mantis into a Latin word, which it's not, making it manti. So that is not correct in any sense of anything ever.
Great explanation. Thank you.
Anyway, there you go.
No, I would say that we're not out of the language game here yet either, because we should also talk about praying versus praying with mantises. So, Jody, you have like a personal story about this.
Do I, or is it a comment that I had? So
you said you've gotten pushback on it before.
Yeah. So the reason why they're called praying, as in praying, P-R-A-Y, is because of the way the raptorial legs are held. And so they are predators and they prey, P-R-E-Y, on, you know, other arthropods, but they're praying, as in they're P-R-A-Y. I'm not doing a really good job of this, but I've had pushback because I posted something once about a praying mantis, saying that they were out and about, you know, ones that you may see every day. And it was just to educate people about what they're looking at, what they're seeing, what the Uthika look like, and that they stay there through the winter, and, you know, what males and females look like. And if you're interested, check out, you know, this fact sheet or whatnot. And someone wrote in and said, there are no praying, P-R-A-Y-I-N-G, mantises in this post. Mantis religiosa is praying mantis. None of these are that. If you quit teaching the wrong common names, it will make proper names easier to learn and quits the fear-mongering that all mantis are praying, P-R-A-Y-I-N-G, when it's only one species from Europe. Period.
Well, that seems overly pedantic. I mean, they're correct. Yes. Mantis religiosa, the European mantis, the species name is religiosa, like religious or praying or whatever. But like, come on, my dude, it's fine. People call Chinese mantises praying mantises all the time. Nobody cares.
Yes. We had to shut down that post.
Well, so which one's right then, Mike?
It should be praying, P-R-A-Y, because it's mantis religiosa.
Well, I mean,
if I'm
talking about all mantises, my understanding was always that it was A-Y.
Yes, all mantises is P-R-A-Y-I-N-G. Praying mantis technically only refers to European mantises, mantis religiosa, period. Right. That is the only species that has that common name. Who cares? People call all other mantises praying mantises too. All other mantises, if you're going to be doing that, should be praying, P-R-A-Y, mantises. Nobody I have ever seen calls them P-R-E-Y mantises.
Yeah.
But I think that's pushback. Like, they don't want to be religious. We want to strip that out of everything. So we're going to go praying with an A to praying with an E to get rid of it. I don't know. That's dumb.
I don't disagree. Yeah, because I guess they're holding their legs. It's not religious. It's not even like commenting on religion. It's just a gag on how they're holding their arms.
Yeah, I end up having to write like blah 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 blah. I understand your concern with the translation / religious reference of the scientific name, but I am correct in my reference. Thank you for your concern.
Is this on Facebook?
It was.
I'm going to dig this one up. Take a close look at that. So we kind of set the stage here. We've talked about what these species are, who they are. Had a little bit of a language lesson. Thanks, Mike, for digging into your Latin and Greek. And I think now we're ready to kind of talk about, why are people so angry at the Chinese mantis?
Racism?
I mean, yeah, COVID. Like, can we talk about that?
Yeah, no, let's open that can of worms.
It is a can of worms. I expect we might get some pushback on this, but I find this very weird. I find that maybe the timing of it is what has created a lot of the suspect nature for me, is that I started getting these questions right around the time that people were really complaining about China and coronavirus, and were conflating those things together. And then all of a sudden I started getting people like, well, I want to destroy Chinese mantises. I need to kill these. I'm finding them in my landscape. And I guess that what took me by surprise is like, this isn't a new thing. I was confused why people were suddenly like, oh, I got to get rid of these. They haven't invaded recently. These have been around for over 120 years at this point. I think 1890 is what gets thrown around as an introduction point for Chinese mantises. And so it's not like we're at the forefront of an invasion here that we can maybe cut off Napoleon style. I try to work in Napoleon every episode.
I appreciate it.
It's happened. Like, they're here. They're non-native. It is true. And I was very confused as to why. And the more I thought about it, the more I really came up with it's racism. And I want to hear what you guys have to think about that.
I agree. I think it goes along with a lot of the anti-Asian sentiments that have been going around. If people have suffered with COVID, I mean, it's been a tough time the last couple of years. And if they feel like this is what they're seeing and they're being invaded with all these invasive insects, and we have what, the Asian giant hornet, and we have the Japanese beetle, and we have, I mean, I don't even know how many, emerald ash borer, all the things.
Asian jumping worms.
Oh, yes. So many different things, and they're all bad. So I think with the Uthika of the Chinese mantid, they're more, people see them more often because they are out in their garden and they're typically laid on like vegetation. So in the winter, when all the leaves fall off of plants or they're cleaning up their garden, they're going to see these things. And that's their way of actually doing some kind of action to stop these invasions. So that, I mean, that's what I think.
I think that is all true, which is why I brought it up. I think there is an underlying component as well of, you know, they eat monarchs, and there's been this big push in the last 10 years of let's conserve the monarchs and do everything we can. How much milkweed can I personally plant on my property to help the monarchs? And even the snapback against European honeybees, like when the first like Save the Pollinators came out, it was all honeybee focused and colony collapse disorder. And then the last 5 years, there's been like, oh, wait, honeybees are bad, actually. We need to conserve native pollinators. And, you know, people are starting to recognize like European honeybees are not native. So I think that is part of it. It's all kind of wrapped up together. Like trying to conserve natives is good. Getting rid of the invasives is bad, but it also feels like there's an undercurrent of nativism there.
For sure.
Let's get rid of the invasives because they stand in for foreign peoples, which sucks because we do need to control invasive species that are destroying the environments, but like people aren't animals. We need to distinguish those and not conflate the two. And it's all kind of like there's good parts of controlling some of these things, but like it's being conflated in weird ways and in ways that I think a lot of people aren't even necessarily conscious of.
Right. It feels all very sentimental. Like there's a lot of sentiment that is bleeding from one thing into the other. And I don't know that we mean for it to always, like, I don't think that the people who've contacted me about killing Chinese mantises are necessarily racist. Like, I don't want to say that that's the case, but there are like racist sentiments that have leaked into our conversations in regarding invasive and non-native species. I also think that that language gets people very confused. Like, technically speaking, I would say this is a non-native rather than an invasive. It's an introduced species is another way to say it. With invasive, you kind of have to have this like documented impact on the habitat that you are trying to exclude it from. And I know that it's kind of an ipso facto thing. Like it's here. Carolina mantises seem lower somehow to people in population than they used to be. Although I haven't seen that documented anywhere really. Like I haven't seen proof that this mantis is actually reduced native species biodiversity. So Mike has his eyebrows up.
Yeah. So I should have dug it up. I read a paper a little while ago that it depends on the specific habitat. In certain habitats, non-native Chinese and narrow-wing mantises do outcompete Carolina mantises, like period, they do.
Right.
In other habitats, they don't.
Okay.
And so it seems like it is habitat specific. And it's not happening everywhere. And so like, it's one of those like competition with native species is never great.
Right.
Well, but they're also like, not going to like wipe them out.
Like, well, and I feel like I'm arguing semantics too. Like, oh, you have to have documented proof. I mean, we know intrinsically that this has probably happened, right? Like a non-native species was introduced. Like, of course it's done something. It's changed for forever the habitat that it has come into. Like that's just, it has to have happened. And then I've read these other things. It was a conservation group in New York City, I think in Central Park even, and they had done like a very coordinated, they went out in the sectors of the park and gotten rid of all the Chinese mantis egg cases that they could find. And I think purposely put in Carolina ones. And now they have sort of like a thriving local population of Carolina mantises. And they were drawing this conclusion about, oh, you know, that means that the Chinese mantis is what's suppressing this. But really, it seemed more like they had purposely helped the Carolina mantis more than just taking out the Chinese mantis. I mean, yeah, there are problems with this. And there's, it's not great that we have a non-native species that's sort of front and center. But it is very charged, the language that people use about it. It seems to focus a lot on the Chinese part. We found that Facebook group. I'm not going to link to it necessarily, but it's called like Kill the Chinese Mantis, right? Or Destroy the Chinese Mantis. It just feels like China and Chinese is really what's got people queued up. I haven't found the same sort of verbiage being used to talk about the European mantis. And I find that slightly telling, I guess.
Yeah, I haven't seen it for European or narrow-wing mantis. And honestly, those three species aren't the only introduced species of mantises in the United States. Like I mentioned, Yucatan little mantises are introduced. There's a number, I have to count, but at least four or five other species that are widespread. Mediterranean mantises are introduced into the Southwest United States. Nobody's saying to kill them. There's a number of other widespread, reasonably large species that are introduced. And none of them get the attention that Chinese mantises get for like eradication. Chinese mantises are the biggest species.
Right.
To be fair.
Something like, to be said. Yeah.
Right. They're the biggest ones. They're eating everything. They're the ones eating hummingbirds.
If you go on YouTube and you look up hummingbirds, praying mantids, there are other species other than Chinese mantids doing so. And I will also want to say, like, you know, we put out hummingbird feeders. What are we doing that for? So we could see the hummingbirds. Right? Not because we're trying to conserve them. So we're putting this out there. The hummingbirds are coming to feed because we're selfish. We want to see them. And then we get all mad at praying mantises for eating the thing that's flopping in their face. You know, like, so also, like, we're doing that. It's kind of like you're letting your cat go out and kill birds. There are other things going out there to kill birds, but it's because this Chinese mantis is eating the birds a problem.
I feel like that's got to be like the shark attack of the hummingbird world, right? Like, what are the odds that you're going to be attacked by a praying mantis as a hummingbird? It can't be a significant contributor to hummingbird mortality, can it?
I don't think so.
Mike, what are your thoughts?
I mean, but also it's the same thing with like monarchs. I get multiple calls every year. Like, oh, I found this Chinese, I hate saying it like, Chinese mantis. We need a better common name, better common names, people. But this Chinese mantis, and there were all these butterfly wings under, and I'm like, yeah, they're generalist predators that eat anything. And this one's on a flower. Like, it's going to be eating butterflies, natives and non-natives. Like, yeah, they eat monarchs. They also eat cabbage whites and other non-native butterflies. Like, they eat whatever you put in front of them.
And then what else eats monarchs? Yellow jackets, paper wasp, the predatory stink bug, you know, like, oh, but that's okay because they're small. We don't really see that. Well, I see that. It's the circle of life out there. We can't go around like interfering and killing like all the things that are killing the things we like, because it's up to us what we think is good or what we think is bad. You know, we think that wasps are bad because they will sting us. But then, you know, these stink bugs are good because they prey on our pests, but then they're also eating the monarch caterpillars. So now they're bad. It's very confusing. So who do we kill? Like, and they want to know, and they want us to tell them.
They want lines drawn.
We've told people to kill all of the spotted lanternflies they can.
True.
And they're not native. So why shouldn't we kill all of these mantises that aren't native too?
Yeah. And then some praying mantises kill the spotted lanternfly. So then they're good when they're doing that. what are we supposed to, how are we supposed to deal with that? Like, what is the difference between those invasives, right? The ones that are actually economic damage or forest damage and crop damage. How do we, I mean, well, we have the whole thing on spongy moth.
I think what you're getting at even more is like a philosophical question that we as entomologists are pushed into all the time, which is like, how much control do you really expect to be able to exert over nature? Like, we have arbitrarily designated monarch butterflies as like this wonderful insect. There is nothing intrinsically valuable about a monarch over other insects. But we want to like categorize bugs that interact with them as good or bad because of what they're doing to this insect that we just have sort of said like, oh, this is ours. This is our mascot bug that we want to love and preserve. We don't get to decide all that. Like, we don't get to say who does what in nature and make those sorts of decisions. There are going to be mantises. The mantises are going to mantis and eat what they want. And sometimes that's going to be your favorite bug. Sorry. We can't change that. And killing the Chinese mantises that you find isn't going to change that either, because then the Carolina mantises are just going to do the exact same thing. We've got pictures of them doing it as well. So it's a niche. Like, it's just a job to do. Somebody's got to eat a butterfly. And it just so happens these ones are the biggest and most obvious ones that do it.
So I think we're kind of getting into our responses to clients. I take a similar tact, but I think I frame it differently. So we mentioned that Chinese mantises were introduced in the 1890s. They're widespread at this point. They've been here for 130 years. They're well-established. They are absolutely everywhere you look. If it was something like spotted lanternfly, where they got introduced 5 or 10 years ago and there was a hope of eradicating them, fine, kill every last one of them, because that means something, that could do something. But they're so widely established at this point, it doesn't matter if you kill every mantis that you find and Uotheca that you find. Like, they're just going to come in from your neighbor's property. It, like, what you can do as an individual person is a drop in the bucket. So let them live. That's fine. It doesn't matter. Kill everyone you find. That's fine. It doesn't matter. Like, the damage has been done, ecological, whatever. There's nothing we can do going back, and there's no way to eradicate them barring some kind of system-wide change, like the introduction of a biocontrol agent. Like, there's nothing that you can do as an individual or even that we could do as a society that would wipe them out. And so it doesn't, who cares? Like, we're past the point of doing anything meaningful. So however you react to them is a fine reaction, because they're not native. If you want to kill them all, I don't care. They're not native. If you want to let them all live, that's fine. I don't care, because they're going to be out there anyhow, regardless of what you do.
So do you just write like, dear so-and-so, who cares?
No.
Dr. Scobarla.
No, I summarize it a lot nicer, but I do frame it like it doesn't matter either way. Like, kill them or leave them. You have, as an individual, no impact. And so it doesn't matter.
This is what I wrote. I acknowledge that some individuals desire a purely native landscape, and they don't want non-native plants or organisms in their garden. That is up to the individual and what they choose to plant and buy and purge and destroy. The Chinese mantid is well established across the U.S., and actions of killing every Uotheca a person finds in their landscape will not make a difference in the overall population. As well, there's no evidence that the existence of Chinese mantids at this time will cause economic or environmental concern in each area. And then I said some things to consider, and kind of talk about the different types of mantids. And then I also say, like, just don't buy any and bring it into your environment. And usually then that's the other question. Cause I'm like, look, there's one thing to like deal with your landscape, but there's another thing. Like, if you're buying things and bringing it in, like, you're part of the problem. I see Mike smiling.
I was going to say, can we talk about that part of it? But you
about
but
people buying Uotheca's?
Yeah. But do you think, like, is that response then a similar response to what you're saying?
Okay. It's pretty much the same. I like the bringing in part too, because I think that's another effort in futility, because it's just the dumbest thing. People buy these Uotheca, which, one, just go out to a field and collect them because they're easy to find once you get what you're looking for. Like, you could get 50 of them for free in 10 minutes. It's not hard. But people release them in like multicolored Asian lady beetles in their gardens with this idea, like, I'm going to put them in my garden and they're going to eat all the bugs, except they walk and fly. And if there's not enough things to eat, they just leave. So it doesn't, you don't get, they're generalist predators once. So they eat everything. They eat the bad things. Mm-hmm. They eat the good things in your garden. But like, they got legs. If there's nothing for them to eat in your garden right now, they're not going to wait a week and maybe starve while that pest comes in.
Right.
They're just going to go away.
Yeah. And how many of those Euthica actually, like some of them are just not viable, right? Like some of them have been parasitized. Right. So you get like the reviews on their websites. It's just like, I'm very disappointed in this. No praying mantis is.
I just got a bunch of wasps.
Well, and that, I mean, that's a whole conversation that we all need to have more often about biocontrol, about the nature of like preventative action versus curative action. There is the possibility, like if you release multicolored lady beetle in an area with a bunch of soybean aphids, they could stick around and eat a bunch of your aphids and help to push that pest pressure down and suppress it to a level where it's either not causing economic harm or it's more manageable through insecticide intervention. But no, you can't just go out in May and release 5,000 lady beetles and say, now I won't see any aphids this year. Because if there's nothing there for them to eat, like Mike said, they're going to take off. Also, if they've been shipped in a box to the U.S. Postal Service, I know my first instinct wherever I showed up would be to leave because I just got knocked around in the mail quite a bit as well. So, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of education. That's why we're in extension.
Oh, and just the idea, like it's your small home garden. Like that's not a big habitat. If you're like even releasing biocontrol in a big ag field, like it's not, it's an open system. It's not like releasing biocontrol right. agents into a greenhouse where you've got them contained and.
Right. Which like, where most of our successful stories of biocontrol research come from is greenhouses and high tunnels.
Yeah. They're not going to stick around in an open environment where they can fly to the next field over.
But right. it should be talked about in terms of preserving natural populations that occur in and around the margins of agricultural production.
Oh yeah.
We need to maintain some, but augmentative biocontrol, putting them out there, releasing them in those situations is a lot different than conservation biocontrol. Oh,
yeah. I do conservation biocontrol in my own garden. Like
right.
plant flowers, bring in parasitoids, give them areas of support to bring them in and attract them, and then they'll do the job for you. But
right, a polycultural approach where there's multiple things that they can live on and enjoy.
Yeah, identify what your pests are, because there's going to be a targeted management. And with a generalist predator, I mean, if you're like, oh, I have scale insects here, let's release praying mantises.
Right, they're not going to peel them up and gobble them up.
Not going to work.
No. I thought this was an important conversation to have, frankly, because I do feel like Mike hit it on the head with, he said something about nativism. There's nativism that goes on culturally with humans. I think like we think about America and America first or whatever, however you want to put it. I don't know. But then I think that some of that has somehow weirdly seeped into conversations about introduced non-native, invasive, and native species. Like we run into these like all native people. They only want to have the native plants in the landscape, which in theory is fine. I don't know what your experiences have been with that, but like it also gets a little frustrating to have somebody say, well, you shouldn't promote Russian sage to help bumblebees out because it's from Russia. I can't stop Lowe's from selling it, I guess. So I just thought we should have this conversation about this weird sentiment that's seeped into talking about mantises. It creeps me out a little bit.
My final thought on that is like, with my little 2.5 acres, I do try to keep everything native, but because what was in the forest before was invasive privet and honeysuckle that nothing feeds on. Like it is a food desert for birds because there's nothing out there for them to eat. So by going in and hacking all that out and planting natives, I can support more caterpillars that brings the birds in. But like I've also got hosta planted out front, which isn't native because it doesn't spread very much, if at all, here. I've heard in the Northwest it can be a problem, but in Pennsylvania it's not invasive. It has good flowers for pollinators. It looks pretty, so, and it's by the front road. Like it's not in a place where it matters for native species. But in the back where I'm trying to get birds, like that's almost all natives because the invasives didn't support the insect diversity to support the birds that I want. So I think it's a sliding scale, and I determine what stays and goes based on how like its interactions with other organisms in the environment.
What you're trying to say is that there's nuance to this conversation.
Yes.
That perhaps there's room for things to exist if we can control them a little more than letting them go.
Well, it's easy to control that privet. I just hit it with a brush hog. I know what it is. I know where it is.
Right.
I can't control the mantises.
No.
Wouldn't try if I wanted to. So.
Well, and you can do something about privet and honeysuckle on your 2 acres, but I'm guessing that the next 2 acres over, there's probably still a lot of honeysuckle.
Right? Yeah. Well, don't look in forests in Pennsylvania. That's literally all the undergrowth.
Yeah. Jody, do you have any wrap-up thoughts?
As entomologists, do people ask you, well, what would you do? Like, what are your thoughts about that? So, you know, we want to say all the stuff that's research or the science-based stuff. But I think for me as a person, like, I just appreciate things for what they are, whether it's the sky or a plant or an arthropod. So I don't kill anything. I just don't want things inside the house. I don't want, you know, my dog or kid to get tick-borne disease. So, you know, I do the things that we can to prevent those things, but I have a lot of plants and flowering plants. I have a lot of bees and flies. I don't have a big yard at all. And I've got both mantids all the time. And I rarely see the Carolina mantid Uthica, but I have more of those than I have Chinese mantids every year. I don't have a problem with them. I've seen them both on the same plant and they just ignore each other. There's enough food for all of them. They're all catching flies and bees and the pollinating flies. Like they're all like good. They're all bugs to me. So to me as an entomologist, they're good. They're good for me to see. I plant things for pests. I don't do pest management in my garden. I'm observing. You know, most of the time they fly off. All the males fly off. The females get to stay and they play their egg cases there. And I just love praying mantids. I just love the species that I have. I have no favorites. I love watching them I love them doing their mantis things. And yeah, sometimes it's cannibalistic. I love that too. That was fun. it brings me great joy to be able to see life of all kinds there. So, you know, I let things live and I don't judge if somebody doesn't want to plant a non-native plant there.
Right.
But it's also, but it's also, there are a lot of other non-natives that we have in the garden that people accept because, you know, for whatever reason. So I try to be, I guess, fair in that way.
I think that's a fair way of putting it.
Right.
We don't endorse it one way or the other, frankly.
Right. But if they're like, I don't like this, but you know, I love honeybees. It's, you know, these are not native either. And if you think that the Chinese mantid is out competing and eating all the bugs, like are the, you know, the European honeybee taking all the pollen away from our natives? Is that the same thing?
Empirically, you know? Yes. There was a paper on that a couple months ago.
Right. And so, but it's right. But that's not what people want to think about. Right. There's a lot of European hornet, the European paper wasp, it's taken over kind of as the biggest paper wasp and nests everywhere.
And murderizes monarchs on a grand scale.
All the time. Yeah. Oh, I have. Yeah. Do you want all, I don't know, for show notes, do you want like all the things that murder monarchs? Because I have these, you know, these pictures and it's like, oh, that's horrible. But then I'm like, this is life.
No, I right? agree. And I mean,
people love butterflies, but they cannot stand when caterpillars eat their dill, parsley. And I'm like, you know, that's the same insect. You can't have a beautiful butterfly without just letting this happen or plant more for yourself, plant things.
We're struggling to put a punctuation mark on this conversation because I think it's like an ongoing cultural tug of war about native versus non-native plants, How do we like build a landscape up that can be robust and support nature around us? This pining for a landscape that frankly doesn't exist anymore. Like we have done the damage.
It never existed.
Right. Yeah. People that colonized this continent have already ruined all that. Like we will never go back to what it really truly is native. There's no way to really put a punctuation mark on this. Like,
it's complicated.
The Chinese mantis is now like this, to me, is emblematic of this conversation in a way that things like Russian sage and a few others were a few years ago. But I don't think that we as entomologists, we as arthropod, like we can't endorse it one way or the other. If you need to feel better about getting rid of them, that's your landscape. You get to decide that. If you don't, then they're not going anywhere anyway. Sorry. That's not a very hopeful note to end on, perhaps.
I mean, there are things that prey on the Chinese praying mantis, like birds and bats, correct? Like, yep, they have predators too. And maybe if people do not want their hummingbirds eaten by praying mantids of any kind, maybe, you know, consider where you're putting them and not have big plants beside them or whatnot. It's like when you plant a garden and then you don't want bees there.
You don't control the world. Sorry, folks. On these hopeful notes, it's been a pleasure to have everybody on the show here today. Talk about mantises, get a little bit of a language lesson, and then some philosophical debate. If you want to share how you feel about European and Chinese mantises in the Twitterverse with us, you can find the show. We are at @arthro_podshow. I am at Bugman John.
I am at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at mscavarla36.
So we'd be happy to hear your comments there. You can also leave a rating and review wherever you find the show and listen to it. We're on Spotify, Arthro-Pod. We are also on Stitcher and all of those other podcatchers that are out there. And you can find the show online and the show notes at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. We hope that you'll tune in here again soon in a couple of weeks for another entomological episode.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.